This is the CineSnob Podcast.
Hi, and welcome to episode 239 of the CineSnob Podcast. I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Villafania.
Cody, it was the NBA draft this week.
Yeah.
Are you excited about the Spurs? Three first-round draft picks. That's the most ever? Or most in an awful long time.
I mean, it has to be. I mean, I am surprised that they kept all of them. I thought that they were going to consolidate picks. I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that their first, the first guy they got, Jeremy Sochan, was a guy I did not want them to get because, like, he's one of those guys who, like, he has a lot of comparisons to, like, Draymond Green or Sean Marion, where, like, he's, like a suffocating defender who averages, like, under 10 points a game, and like apparently has no shot, shot 50% from the free throw line. But like, I was listening to Bill Simmons' podcast, because he's like Bill Simmons' favorite player in the draft, and he was basically saying like he's a guy who may not put up a shot in 5 minutes but be the best player on the floor, which again, I like the idea of like a good glue guy like that, but when you have a top 10 pick, I don't love it. But then with their second pick, they got a guy named Malachi Branham, who is apparently like typically Spurs, like possibly one of the best players in the draft who just fell into their laps, a guy who can score. So I ended up being pretty excited about the picks. It's going to be a little bit of time, I think, before everyone pans out. But yeah, it's going to be very different for the Spurs over the next like 5 or 10 years, where they finally have this like young, super young core of players and building from the ground up for real.
I remember when they used to stash guys, like they'd pick like a Euro player and then like you'd never ever see him again.
Yeah, with their first round pick, they just draft like Stimmy Solokovic and then just, and then you would never ever see him.
Yeah, those were the days. Those were the salad days though, like when things were going great.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you didn't care about the draft because you were going to be a contender for a championship every year for the next, you know, 5-10 years. So
yeah,
but this year it was exciting to actually be interested in the draft too and see the team come to shape. And like even reading a bunch of like draft grades or winner loser articles, the Spurs were in the draft winners. Like, you know, the pundits all think that they did a great job. So.
I didn't attend, but I sent this to you. They had a major draft party here in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
So the Spurs are going all in on becoming a regional team. I'm curious how well that's going to work. Because I believe is it next season or the season after where they're playing a couple of games here in the Moody Center? Is it 2023?
No, it'll be this next year.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be two games in Austin next year.
I'm really curious to see how that works out, especially when they're not as great as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious to see what the crowd looks like for one of those games. I would love to go. I don't know. I need to look up some dates, but
I mean, I'm fairly confident they'll sell that out pretty easily. I mean,
it is a smaller arena than
I think
AT&T.
It's more like 13,000 or 14,000 or something like that.
I think basketball capacity is maybe 15.
Okay.
Maybe that might be concert. I don't know. It's significantly lower. Will the AT&T Center be renamed this coming season, or is that next year?
Yeah.
Shit, what's it gonna be?
Oh shit. I don't know yet, but it looks like the Moody Center basketball capacity is 10,000, so they'll sell that out easily.
Yeah. That'll be no sweat. Yeah. I mean, it's gonna scare all the diehards that think that the team is going to leave, but
Yeah. And you know, I think, it'll be interesting to see if they get an Austin sponsor because they had an Austin sponsor for their jersey patch, in a multi-year agreement, which was the first like other big move. And so like, is it going to be like the Dell Center? That'll be interesting to see what arena gets the naming rights.
Oh, you mean in San Antonio? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that'd be crazy. I don't.
Like
Dell would
be an Austin
company. Yeah, Dell would be. I mean, it is an Austin-based company. It's a little probably too international to be. So, like, it wouldn't drive the point home. Like, if it was something like the. Fuck, I don't know.
Torchy's Arena.
Yeah. The P. Terry's Arena. then that would be something else. But I can't imagine someone like HEB leaving that on the table.
Oh, I can't either. I mean, I think it almost has to be HEB. But, you know, We'll see.
Yeah.
But it'll be this year for sure. But yeah, I'm excited for the season.
Yeah, I've been looking at buying another jersey. I haven't bought a Spurs jersey in years, and now I'm thinking about buying. I don't know what to get though. It's hard to find the Fiesta colors or the First City Edition Fiesta Edition.
Oh, the black ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the best ones so far.
The white ones. I don't know. I can't pull off white very well.
I don't love the white ones. You know, the thing that would be cool is supposedly they're doing those black on black, like Gervin era jerseys this next season, which I've been waiting for forever. I think most Spurs fans have been. That might be cool. But the first year Fiesta editions were fantastic. I love those jerseys.
I can't say that I dislike the white, but I just can't pull it off personally. Yeah. All right. Anything else before we move on? We've talked Spurs.
No, we've talked enough basketball on our movie podcast. Let's go ahead and...
All right, yeah. Let's go ahead and get started on reviews.
Here are this week's reviews.
First up, we have Elvis.
But this ain't no nostalgia show. We're going to do something different.
Comic book heroes all find their superpowers. Elvis found music.
Bring that bass up, Jerry.
I wish to promote you, Mr. Presley.
I believe I can be great. Ba-da-bum, ba-da-bum.
Some people wanted to put me in jail.
It's a Wells movie.
Don't so much as wiggle a finger.
I'm gonna show you what the real Elvis is like.
In that moment, Elvis, the man, was sacrificed. And Elvis, the god, was born.
This is from director Baz Luhrmann, probably most famously known for Moulin Rouge. Also did a movie, I think probably the last movie of his I saw all the way through was Romeo and Juliet.
The last one for me is Great Gatsby.
I never saw that one, and I never saw Australia either. I have seen parts of Moulin Rouge. Anyway, this is a biopic of sorts. Cody, tell us about Elvis and what you thought of it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly more of a biopic than I would have expected coming from Baz Luhrmann, who, you know, sort of stylistically is like a glitter throw up of a director where, like, you know, like everything sparkles and is like extravagant and big and giant I think it is somewhat restrained filmmaking from Luhrmann. And it is a somewhat straightforward biopic on Elvis. That being said, I think the narrative structure of it is the thing that sets it apart, in my opinion, for worse. I don't really know if it's for better. But yeah, it just kind of tracks Elvis's life and career, you know, kind of going back and forth from when he was a kid to when he was a little bit older and coming out in the music industry to kind of his stardom and then to the sort of end of his life. And it's told through, like, the narrative device of being told from the perspective of Colonel Tom Parker, who was his manager. I don't know that that narrative device does a whole lot for the movie. I didn't particularly care for it, I don't think, especially with Parker talking directly to the audience as opposed to just kind of narrating the story. I didn't care for that much. And I think... You know, the number one thing that happened when this movie came out was a lot of talk about the trailer, which featured Tom Hanks speaking in a very indistinguishable European accent.
It's very I've heard it. It's very Goldmember, if you're familiar with Austin Powers and Goldmember.
Ah, okay, yeah, yeah.
Isn't yeah. that weird? Like that sort of.
Goldmember, great movie. Yeah, so and I think the first thing I will say to sort of like quell some of that is that it's certainly strange, but I think in the context of the movie, I had no problem with it. I think it's fine. Mm-hmm. I think once you settle into the accent choice, I think it's a fine performance from Hanks. Tom Hanks is rarely ever like phoning it in, and I don't think he's phoning it in here. I think it's a fine performance. I think. You know, the star of the movie is Austin Butler, who I think is really, really good here as Elvis. And I think you can't. So there's a lot of conversation between like when you see a biopic of like is it making the character their own or just doing an impression or whatever? And I think that to some degree with someone like Elvis, you kind of have to do an impression or people are going to get mad. You know, like if right. Elvis doesn't sound like Elvis or look like or like have mannerisms or like trying to do a voice or something like that. And I think for that part, Butler really nails it. I think he looks and sounds like Elvis. I think he's doing a lot of singing in the early part of Elvis's career. I think the voice sounds great. I think he's performs really well. And I think it's a good acting performance. I think where the movie starts to fall apart for me is in a couple of things. I think that the pace for the movie just never really settles in for me. And I find myself kind of like really disliking the pace of it all. You know, it starts off really quick through like quick cuts and montages and like they'll bring something up and then show a huge montage about it and then fire off to the next thing. It's like very rapid fire, very quick, very stuffed early on. And then somewhere like mid movie, it all slows down. It all grinds to a halt for me. And it starts getting really repetitive and you're like, okay, yes, I get it. You know, Tom Parker has his thumb over Elvis, and then they just kind of show that over and over again. And I quite honestly got a little bit bored with it. So I had, you know, that sort of like pacing whiplash going on where early on I was overwhelmed almost mm-hmm. with how much was going on. And then towards the end of the movie, I was bored. And I don't think those two things should be happening in the same movie. Visually, I think it looks great. I think the one thing about Baz Luhrmann's movies is that you know they're going to look great. And I think there's a lot of interesting camera work. There's a lot of interesting like edits and cuts, you know, a lot of like spinning cameras that will cut into the next scene or something yeah. like that. You know, it's creative filmmaking for sure. And I think there's a lot to be said for like there's a lot of really good scenes within the movie. I think almost anything that involves music is really well done. I think there's like great scenes of like you see in the trailer of like Elvis putting together his band for his Vegas residency. Great sequences there. There's really great sequences of live performances that he puts on. I think the best sequence of the movie is him shooting his TV special at NBC. Yeah.
It's supposed to be a Christmas special.
Yeah, and it sort of gets hijacked as like a Elvis Returns kind of thing. I love that whole sequence of the movie, but it's one of those things where I don't ever think it adds up to being like a great movie. I think that there's little pieces, there's little collections of stuff, but then the pace will do something or it'll do something repetitive or it'll be something that feels a little bit sanitized, which I think, you know, you get that sense throughout the movie, especially when in regards to like Elvis's drug problem. It's sort of glossed over. I mean, it's shown, but it's not like to the depths to where it actually was. And so, you know, it's a really mixed bag for me. I appreciate the ambition of it, but I feel like there's too many like pace changes for me to stay fully engaged. And I wish that it would have kind of picked a lane and stuck with it. So a collection of a lot of good scenes and then a lot of stuff that I just wasn't interested in at all.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to disagree a little bit on the pacing. I kind of felt like, you know, I went into this thing kind of the same way you did and maybe a little bit biased toward the idea that Tom Hanks was going to be wacky as shit. Once the movie started and it settles into what it's going to do with Hanks, I think I started to really enjoy it and I felt it. I found it really captivating. I called it last week, and I can't remember if I said it on the show or said it after the show, but I called it like a capital M movie. And I feel like it really is because the scope is so huge following. And because what I mean by that is Elvis himself is a huge topic to tackle. Because whether you're familiar with Elvis like his career or not, like the image of him and the idea of Elvis is sort of burned into the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, tackling that, I think in a straight biopic wouldn't have been nearly as riveting as this was for me anyway. I like you said, I don't think the movie gets better than the Christmas special recording. I think the latter half is a little bit repetitive. Sure. And I think it gets a little bit ridiculous when, they're playing, you know, Hanks is playing Tom Parker, who by all accounts was not nearly that heavily accented. If you watch any sort of video of him, playing him as like a European goofball half the time. And that Elvis at the end is like, you're not even a citizen of this country, are you? Like, no shit. Like, you kind of spent that nickel already.
You just figured that out. Yeah.
But, you know, and that's fine. I mean, that's a stylistic choice the movie made. And I think it finally has to, you know, it has to get down to brass tacks at that point and sell its point home. But I think in the interim, though, I think it, glossing over all that stuff, it benefits it. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that is undesirable about Elvis. Probably most pointedly is the relationship with Priscilla Presley, which is very glossed over in this. He's played as like this, you know, 20, you know, young GI, and she's like an 18-year-old, roughly, woman in the film, when in reality he was 24 and she was 14, so it's way grosser.
Yeah.
But, you know, that said, Priscilla Presley is heavily involved in this film, so clearly sure. She doesn't want to portray it in that light. And then, like you mentioned, the drug use is sort of, it's expressly mentioned, but it never, you know, it leaves out the indignity of Elvis dying on the toilet, you know?
Yeah. Or just the idea that, like, for like the last couple years of his career, apparently, like, they could barely keep him propped up on stage. He was unintelligible.
Right. And you do see that a tiny bit when he's singing that last song. I forget what the song is. And it cuts to like the real footage of him.
Unchained Melody?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. It cuts to the real footage of him. And it's this guy is 37 years old in that fucking video. And it's like, holy shit, this guy is dying.
Yeah.
This guy who was electric. And just this incredible performer, and he's just falling apart at, you know, the age I was 6 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But that said, you know, I don't know that I would want to watch a straight biopic of Elvis. You know, I feel like he's probably too big for that. Like, the myth of Elvis is too big for, like, you can't get a Walk the Line sort of.
Yeah,
straightforward biopic out of this.
Which, speaking of, it just has to be said, the sort of like staying power of Walk Hard as a parody, just like consistently calling this stuff out, predicting it, because there's moments in all of these movies, even after that, even this movie, where it's like this was so done perfectly by Walk Hard. That movie has so much staying power.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know. That kind of reminds me of like when you watch a movie that's adapted, or like when you and I watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid for our other podcast we did, when you're like, oh, here's where all that shit came from.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's where this buddy comedy thing came from. And you look at like the life of Elvis, you're like, oh, there's where everything in Walk Hard came from. Like, just this extravagant horse shit.
Which, by the way, this is the second Elvis movie after The Identical.
I still never saw The Identical.
God damn, you got to see that movie.
What is it? What's the other Elvis movie?
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that The Identical was the other one. Also, I just want to point out a Twitch comment here. Are you there? You froze. Oh, there you are.
I'm here.
Kingsley says that he never made it past the first 5 minutes of Walk Hard. Man, that is a mistake.
Just wait, watch the unrated one and wait till you get the one with where all the dicks, like, it's like Dewey Cox is sitting on the floor and just all these dicks come like right in his peripheral. Like,
yeah. Yeah. You have to get through Walk Hard and get through the genius parody that's going on there.
Was it like, who are the Beatles? Isn't it like Paul Rudd and Jason Schwartzman and
Justin Long?
Yeah. Okay.
And, Jack Black.
Yes. Anyway, back to Elvis. I mean, look, I'm not the biggest fan of Elvis's music. I mean, it's good. There's some that's like, obviously there's some parts in the soundtrack that are like the gospel stuff, I think, is probably the gospel influenced stuff is probably the best. And the movie glosses over some stuff like his movies, and it kind of rewrites history on him being in the military, like he was technically drafted. It doesn't really matter. Because at the end of it, I think it really works. I don't think the pacing is a problem. But yeah. Anyway, what's your grade, Cody, for Elvis?
Yeah. So I've been back and forth on this one, and I think ultimately I'm going to go with a B minus. I'm going to say that it's good enough to recommend, but it's like, after I left the theater, I was thinking C plus, and then the more I think about it, the more, you know, I got enjoyment out of a lot of it. So I think it just tips the scale into being worth recommending, but it's not by any means a strong recommendation.
I'm going to disagree. I'm going to go with a B plus, just because I thought, like I said, I was captivated the whole way through, and I did not expect to be. I expected to kind of be. Honestly, the Tom Hanks in the trailer, like hearing him talk, made me thought this was going to be like a train wreck.
Yeah.
And I thought it was, I enjoyed it quite a bit. All right, let's move on to our next movie, Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe.
The Earth sucks.
Wait a minute.
I think the floor is not working.
Look at that number up there on the billboard.
There's a 2 and then some kind of circle.
No, dumbass, not that number. That one.
69.
This show sucks. Like, just these fat people standing there.
I am Cornholio! I need TV for my bungalow!
Who are you, fart knockers?
Amusing, yes.
Humorous, yes.
Satirical comment on the time.
Yes, amusing.
26 years after the first Beavis and Butthead movie, how old were you, Cody?
Let's see, it came out in 95, right? I was
96.
Oh, I was 7 then.
So did you go see it in the theater?
Not as a kid, I don't think. Okay. I don't think I came across that until it was maybe like on MTV or something like that.
Okay. So I remember seeing it in the theater. I remember it being a big deal, and it was pretty epic in scope compared to the TV series. However, this is a new film. Premieres on it's available to stream right now on Paramount Plus. Ahead of a reboot that's coming at some point. I know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Cody, tell us about Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe and what you thought of it.
Yeah. Well, look, Do America, even though I didn't see it in theaters at the time, has grown to be, and this is seriously not an exaggeration, one of my favorite comedy movies of all time. I love it. I've seen it so many times. I think it's endlessly rewatchable. And I think, if anything, Do the Universe sort of reinforces like how much of a movie of a miracle that of Do America is, because you know, I think so. I mean, just plot line, it's almost stupid to even talk about the plot line, but you know, the plot line is Beavis and Butthead back in 1998 are sentenced by a creative judge to space camp instead of going to prison. And as part of that space camp, they convince someone to do to go on an actual mission for NASA, and through that they get sent like through a time portal and get transported to 2022, and then they're looking to score, basically. So you know, here's the thing, is that you know, the cartoon part of Beavis and Butthead as a TV show was never my favorite part. My favorite part was, and I think most people's favorite part, was just hearing them make fun of music videos. And the cartoons were fine, but they were also, you know, like 5 minutes long, 6 minutes long. And I think that was for a reason, because, you know, Beavis and Butthead humor is very one note. It's very like, you know, they play the hits, right? They're doing something violent. They're looking to score and they're laughing at stupid shit. Not to say that that's not a winning formula, because obviously I love the show and I love the Do America. But in the case of Do the Universe, I think it starts to sort of show why Beavis and Butthead is best in small doses, because I don't think that they can replicate the same magic here as they did in Do America. The story's really flat. You know, the jokes, while there is the occasional funny stuff, I think really lean into like the ridiculous here. And then it starts to like take the structure of Do America a little bit, where, you know, there's you know, there's the Cornholio bit, which I think in this movie kind of is like really falls flat for me. There's like extended dream sequences. There's even like the same kind of government agencies chasing after them who think they're much smarter than they are. And it starts to, like, again, take shape of Do America just in a much inferior way. And it really is shocking to me after watching this, like, just how good Do America is, because, like, it manages to, like, keep the story interesting, keep it funny, put them in different situations where they can get some comedy out of it. Here, it just felt like it was wearing a little bit. Not to say that I didn't laugh, but it just felt really one note and repetitive for me, to the point where I was like, I don't know that long form is where Beavis and Butthead should live. I think it just needs to be shorter. It needs to have the commentary stuff, and maybe just treat Do America as like a really great movie that they managed to pull off, but maybe not try to do this again.
Well, and you know, the idea of Do America was they had their TV stolen, and they go on a quest to get it back. But like they not go on a quest to get it. They stumble into a quest to get it back. It's low stakes, but with like a very like you said, like there's other people, there's other elements moving the plot along. Like you have Demi Moore and Bruce Willis's characters.
Robert Stack is amazing.
Yeah, Robert Stack is great. What is the cavity search line? It was like, don't stop till you reach the back of his teeth. Like, that's a great line.
And then his whole thing with prepositions and making the guy restructure his sentences.
And the Mr. Anderson, the Tom Anderson, like, running gag. Yeah. Cloris Leachman has a great part in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just there's those elements, they move the plot forward. Those people move the plot forward. Beavis and Butthead are just there. This one has a weird, in addition to mirroring, like, Do America on a much smaller scale, it has a weird, like, the plot seems weirdly necessary. Like, so Do America leaves you at the end with them having gone on this adventure, but not knowing what the fuck happened and ending up with a new TV. This one, like, they go through time and then they end up in a different, like, timeline. Like, it seems weirdly like a setup for whatever's coming next.
Yeah.
Like to explain why Beavis and Butthead are in 2022, which I don't feel like it ever needed. I don't know. The whole, like, jumping through time, which this isn't a spoiler to show that they're, like, they go into 2022. And that's, like, the whole point of the characters hunting them down. But it at the end of it, it's like, I don't know, it just felt like I didn't need this much plotting in my Beavis and Butthead movie. Like, I needed them to be dumb and that's it. Like I love the scenes where they're laughing at stupid shit. Like, I love that. This one probably spends too much time with just Beavis and Butthead.
I think just with them without looking at the wake of whatever their, like, destruction they're causing and totally unaware of, which I think is part of it too.
They need people to bounce off of too. And then there's, like, stuff that's answered too much. Like, you hear about Beavis's mom.
Yeah.
And then,
I will say I liked the voice performance because in the first one, again, like, there's a lot of great voice performances. I think my favorite is Nat Faxon here, who plays the lieutenant governor character. I think is, like, gets some really fun stuff to do here.
What, going back to the first movie, wasn't David Letterman one of their presumed dads?
Yeah. Yes.
yeah. It's just, look. Am I glad that they're back and they're reasonably doing the same thing? Sure. Was it time to hang it up? Probably.
Yeah. I'm with you. By the way, there was this, like, much touted Beavis and Butthead remastered on Paramount Plus with music videos that was supposed to hit alongside this. They put up 7 episodes that were remastered. 7. One from, like, season 4 and, like, 6 from season 7. And that's it.
Did you watch the revival that happened, like, 10 or 12 years ago?
Yeah, I went to the premiere of that at Austin Film Festival at the Paramount. I actually saw the first 2 episodes there.
So I enjoyed that. And they but do you remember how they cheaped out on it and
they were using like old stock footage or old footage from it. Yeah,
yeah, and I was so disappointed because it was like the first. It was like when stuff was being released in HD, mm-hmm. and this was still like in standard def.
Yeah,
it was such a disappointment that they cheaped out on it. But yeah, I enjoyed. So, I think it was like 6 or 10 episodes. Not a whole lot.
Something like that. But they were instead of music videos, it was like MTV programming that they were commenting on, which was funny. But like when they would cut to them just sitting on the couch, it would be like old shit from the
90s. It's all scratchy. I mean, that is such a winning formula. And between like Beavis and Butthead and Mystery Science Theater 3000, like, you know, that sort of humor is funny.
And look, when you say it's time for them to hang it up, I think in long form.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that just like you're saying, that winning formula of having them sit on the couch and like talk shit about stuff, that I think can work. You know, I think that is something that will never get old.
Well, and to be fair, that's like they're different characters when they're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're way more insightful. Smarter. Yeah. 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 I never forget the one. Which one was it? Now I forgot it. God damn it. I got it conflated with the Wayne's World one. Anyway, I screwed up. It was something about Nirvana, and I got it confused with Wayne's World. Never mind. Anyway, what's your grade for Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe, Cody?
I'm gonna give it a C+. I mean, I laughed enough. You know, and it's not as if it is without like stuff that really makes you love and remember Beavis and Butthead. But it's like it gets too bogged down with stuff. It gets really repetitive. It is in like one joke or one note humor over the course of 90 minutes when you're not doing anything to change it up or having them really interact with anyone, like you said, starts to wear a little bit. It's not that as if I think that Beavis and Butthead now is like beating a dead horse. I think you just get back to music videos and you get back to short little cartoons. And I think it can still work. I think Mike Judge still has the voices down really well. And I think Mike Judge with Silicon Valley shows that he can still make good television. I think it's just a matter of I think King of the Hill revival is coming, right?
That one frightens me too, because that show definitely ran out of gas. I love that show.
Mm-hmm.
But that show really ran out of gas, and I'm worried about the fate of that stuff.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, we'll see. But as for just a product here of this movie as is, I'm giving it a C+.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you. C+. I did laugh out loud several times. I just don't think it doesn't feel like it's cribbing from Do America a lot, but at a really tiny scale, and I don't think it ever really Also, this is a really like heady concept too.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's hard. It's really hard to initially buy into. If you want to stream it, it is available right now on Paramount Plus, along with
remastered episodes from the 90s with music videos intact. Paramount said that they're going to be adding more throughout this summer. My guess is it's like a music clearance thing that maybe is holding them up, but. But like to advertise it and then put out 7 episodes out of 200 is just fucking insulting.
I mean, you remember how Conan was supposed to do like every single episode, and then that thing got snagged.
Yeah, that never happened.
Yeah. Well, rights are such a bitch. It's so weird to untangle.
Well, and you would think too, it's Paramount, which so through MTV, this should be like a cinch, but I guess
it is weird because there's all kinds of stuff that goes into it, like Mystery Science Theater 3000, to go back to an example. Like they cycle through like what they're able to stream, like they only maintain the rights for so long, and even with a company like Shout Factory behind it now, they can't secure the rights to everything. It's weird. It's everything that was before streaming, like it's just a nightmare to get those rights. Like, there's a show. Did you ever watch the show Ed that was on NBC? That was a David Letterman
produced.
Was that
the bowling alley one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't, you can't get it. Like, you can't find it anywhere because there was no streaming rights secured. And like,
oh, wow.
I think because they used a lot of contemporary music. I know the theme song was Next Year by the Foo Fighters.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that show is just gone forever.
Is that the there was a do you remember an NBC show about a baker, like a bakery with Breckenmeyer?
I don't.
It was let me look. It was Inside Schwartz. Do you remember?
Oh,
that show?
I remember the title. I never saw the show.
Yeah. Was that it? Breckenmeyer? I don't know. It was some movie that, or some show that was on NBC that I watched as a kid and I really liked, and I've never heard of it again. I think his dad was a baker, but Breckenmeyer played like a sportscaster. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's just gone forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a show my dad wanted me to try to find for him once. It was called Eyeshide, and it was like a detective show from the 70s starring Joe Don Baker, if you know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it's just nowhere. It's mm-hmm. nowhere in the world. Like, it maybe it shows on like antenna TV at 3 a.m, but so much lost media. Anyway, let's move on to our last movie, The Black Phone.
Nothing's going right.
You can let me go.
I'm thinking about it.
I promise I won't tell anyone. You can blindfold me, drop me off on the street, I'll walk home.
Well, tell me your name.
Taylor. Taylor Mullen.
I was really starting to like you, Finny. I almost let you go.
So this is the latest film from Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill, who I believe was Doctor Strange the last one they did together, or did they do something mm-hmm. in between?
Yep.
Anyway, it's a horror movie, as you can see. I didn't see it. Cody, tell us what you thought about The Black Phone.
Sure. So just, you know, plotting wise, the movie is about, it takes place in the 70s, and it's about the Ethan Hawke's character you see there is sort of referred to as the Grabber, who is, there's a series of kidnappings happening in this town, and then you meet like the kid that you see there in the clip, and he has a sister, and they have like an alcoholic father, and that kid ends up being kidnapped, and then we spend the movie trying to, you know, have him escape from the kidnapping and being murdered. This is going to be a tough movie to talk about because it's been a really long time since I have been so split on a movie, where I think that everything about the movie is good, where I think the performances are great. I think you get not one but two really good kid performances with Mason Thames and Madeline McGraw, who play the brother and sister. Jeremy Davies is in the movie, who you remember from Lost, who gives a really good performance. It's typical Jeremy Davies performance, but it's good. And Ethan Hawke is super creepy, you know, in one of like his first villain roles, I think, that he's ever really played.
He was a villain in Moon Knight just now, but yeah.
Yeah. And I think that it is really interestingly shot. I think it looks great. I like the 70s setting. I think the aesthetic adds a lot to the vibe of the movie. I think that it has a lot of tension that is really good, and it kind of builds. And I think the story fucking sucks. and I can't get past the idea that I think the story fucking sucks. The problem here is that it builds this kidnapping story where you know, you're trying to see this kid fight to like get out of it. And the issue is that there are not one, but two supernatural/spiritual links that are sort of relied upon to resolve this story. And these spiritual/supernatural links are things that are just like never explained. There's no detail in any of them. And ultimately they end up being extremely convenient. You know, like So, and I think the movie asks that you kind of go along with these spiritual connections that these kids have. And for me, I never did. I never could. I never connected with that. And, you know, for that reason, I just never connected with the movie on a story level. Because, you know, once you start seeing what the movie is doing with sort of the plotting of the connection that these kids have, you can tell exactly where it's going. I mean, you can see it. But it's one of those things where, like, early on in the movie, they set up that the girl, and this is slight spoiler, but not too bad, where the girl is like, well, sometimes my dreams come true. And you're like, whoa, fuck, okay, cool. Well, I guess that's cool. Never explained, never diving into any detail. And then so suddenly you're like, okay, well, sometimes her dreams come true and she's dreaming about the kidnappings. I wonder where this is going to go. And then, yeah, fuck it, I'll just spoil the rest of it. If you haven't seen it, stop listening. Stop listening right now if you haven't seen it. But then the whole thing is about this black phone that is a phone that is not connected into the wall, that rings, but only like the boy can hear it. And they make mention that Ethan Hawke's character can hear it too. But on the other line of the phone is the disappeared kids who are dead. And so he's talking to the dead kids who are giving him instructions of like, here's what I tried to get out. So now you go try it. And like eventually he builds up enough like good advice to be able to get out. But again, his connection to these dead kids is never explained. The phone just rings. He picks it up, and on the other line is the murdered children that have also been kidnapped. Like, it's never explained. It's never like dove into, and it's so convenient. Like, how convenient is it that like this guy or this kid there has a sister who can, whose dreams come true, and she's getting clues to the mystery in her dreams, combined with this phone that's disconnected that connects him spiritually to the other kids that have been kidnapped. That's certainly convenient that the one kid who got kidnapped just happens to have both of those things available to him. So the second that you start seeing, okay, he's talking to the old kids and the sister is seeing things, you're like, okay, well, yeah, he's going to get rescued through some combination of these things. And of course, that's exactly what happens. And so it sucks because I think that there's so much to like about this movie, but just like the spiritual and supernatural plotting of it all is not only convenient, but it's unexplained. It's not creepy or like off or like eerie or anything like that. And it's just there. And it really creates a very convenient plot that ruins the movie for me. And it sucks because there's so much to like about it otherwise. So that's where I'm torn. And sorry for spoiling it, but I'm angry.
What's your grade for the black phone, Cody?
My grade is a C+, which again, given how much I didn't like those elements, that should tell you how much the other parts are good. I think it's a perfectly effective thriller, but in terms of like its tension, but if you're not on board with just like accepting the reality of these supernatural connections with no explanation or nothing at all, you may have a great time. You may enjoy it. But if you like get hung up on any of that stuff, you're going to sit there stewing for 90 minutes.
Well, all right then. Well, spoiler alert is over now. You can keep listening. But that is going to do it for this week. Next week, we are probably not going to be here, Cody, because it's good old Minions, The Rise of Gru.
Yeah.
And you and I have somehow not seen any Despicable Me movies. I don't know. This is, I guess, the fifth one? I don't know.
Probably, yeah. Does that count the Minions movie?
Yes, because I believe they're all the same.
Okay.
This is a prequel, I guess. It's funny, like, it started as a vehicle for Steve Carell, and then it's just devolved into this Minions shit that I don't get. But the kids seem to like it, and so do boomers that share the memes on Facebook, if that's still a thing that happens. We'll be back for Thor Love and Thunder the next week. If you want to reach us, you can email us at podcast@cinestob.net. You can find us on Twitter @cinesnob, Facebook cinesnob.net, youtube.com/cinesnob, Cody the Ramble.
Sorry, I'm commenting in Twitch.
That's fine.
Ramble is Tuesdays.
I thought that was funny. I'm furious. Thank you.
Ramble Radio Tuesdays and Fridays, regular Ramble on Wednesdays.
All right. On that note, I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
Thank you for listening to the Cine Snob podcast. To read reviews, interviews, and more, visit cinesnob.net. See you next week.